Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Father James Martin. He's the author of Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. It has just been released in paperback version. A little bit about Father Martin. As a Jesuit priest, he's editor-at-large of America magazine. He's consultant to the Vatican's Secretariat for Communication and best-selling author of Seven Last Words, The Abbey, Jesus, a Pilgrimage, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, and Between Heaven and Mirth. Father Martin has written for many publications, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and is a regular commentator in the national and international media. He's appeared on all the major radio and television networks and venues ranging from NPR's Fresh Air to Fox and Friends and PBS's NewsHour and Comedy Central's The Colbert Report. Before entering the Jesuits in 1988, Father Martin graduated from the Wharton School of Business and worked for General Electric for 6 years. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Father James Martin. Hello, sir.
Hello, good to be with you again.
Yes, so last week, for people who may have missed that particular episode, we talked not only about the book, but the response to the book, which from a very small minority, but an extremely vocal minority of uber-Orthodox Catholics. You've received a tremendous amount of criticism. They've called you heretic. They've called you smoke. My favorite is smoke of Satan. I mean, I would... I've never wanted a tattoo, but I don't know. I could be... I could be convinced.
Well, be careful. If you write a controversial book, you might have that applied to you.
You know, one of the things you mentioned last week, the number of clergy, high-ranking clergy, we're talking bishops and cardinals, who have approved of this book, who've spoken glowingly of it. I'm curious, why is there no imprimatur in this book? Is that still a thing?
I'm a member of a religious order, the Jesuits, and we have something called the imprimi potest, which is basically what you get in a religious order, and that means let it be published. So the imprimi potest is from my religious superior, the provincial of the Northeast Province of the Society of Jesus in the United States. So I do have that. And imprimatur is more for a kind of theology book, and this is not a theology book, but I have the official permission from my religious superior to publish, which is what I get as a member of a religious order. So the answer is it basically does have that.
I see. Okay. Thank you. So in your book, we talk about respect, compassion, and sensitivity here, and you talk about each and every one of them. So first of all, when it comes to respect, what do you see is the challenge for people who they don't know anybody in the LGBT community? At least they don't know that they know someone. They don't know somebody who is out to them. And they all of a sudden encounter someone. What's the first thing that has to happen for respect to be engendered?
That is a very good question. I think the first thing is to listen to them, to meet them where they are, as Jesus did with people, to treat them with dignity, to listen to their experience, and to take them seriously, and not to think of them as sinful. You know, I always have people say to me, well, what about hate the sin, love the sinner? And I thought, well, that's a hell of a way to approach somebody. You know, you're a sinner. I mean, everyone is a sinner, right? I mean, imagine if you said, I'm going to meet a group of college kids, right? And, you know, as we know, most college kids are sexually active, right? Many of them. You know, what advice would you have? And you would say to me, hate the sin, love the sinner. I mean, what is that? What about, hey, want to listen to what their challenges are and where they are and how they're struggling in their courses and maybe with their family and maybe with relationships? And the LGBT person is the only one to whom the label sinner is reflexively applied. So the most important thing to answer your question is just listen to them.
And you just brought up something interesting, too. Forget about the college kids for a moment. What about married Catholics whom you might assume are using artificial birth control? Wouldn't they be classified the same way as someone who is gay?
Correct. They, too, are going against church teaching. And that's one of the problematic things about all these firings that are going on of LGBT people who are not adhering to church teaching. We don't use the same litmus tests for straight people. So my favorite example is a young couple, who might be living together before being married. Now, most people just think that's these days, oh, isn't that wonderful, you're getting married, how terrific. And, you know, of course, economically, it's hard for people to live separately, so they're together, and that's so beautiful. Well, that's against church teaching. I don't know of any organization that would fire that person, right? And it's the same thing. We don't say, oh, hey, here's my cousin, and she's living with her fiancé. Oh, well, hate the sin, love the sinner. It the LGBT person, and why do we do that? Because we decide which people we're going to put under the microscope, and it's discriminatory. So you're absolutely right. We have to treat these people like children of God, which is what they are.
Actually, color me naive, I really thought that two heterosexual people living together would get fired from a Catholic organization. That's not necessarily true?
No. They would certainly, no. You know, I mean, maybe if you trumpeted it and, you know, stood up and said, hey, I'm living with, you know, my boyfriend or something, but not the way that LGBT people are treated, which is if there is even a picture on Facebook, it's reported, you know, to the local authorities. There is a case of a man in Canada who had his personal life investigated over 8 years, having, you know, letters sent to the Archbishop, and he was presented with a file, you know, before he was fired, but then said it's filled with, you know, accusations and testimonials about how you're gay and all that kind of stuff, but you can't read them. You know, it's like the Stasi in East Germany,
yeah.
You know, McCarthyism. It's really, you know, so you don't, for example, you don't have a parish or a bishop investigating a young woman who is living together with her fiancé, you know, taking pictures of her, looking at Facebook. That simply doesn't happen because we're okay with that. And we've decided that, you know, we understand that person in the complexity of their relationship. Maybe there's economic problems. Well, okay, they're close to getting married. But the LGBT person is not afforded that compassion or respect or sensitivity. They're just not. And in the past, since 2010, I think 80 people have been fired from their jobs or had job offers rescinded because they're LGBT.
Let's talk about clergy. I'm sure you know men and probably women religious who are gay. And I understand that there is a movement to really restrict men and women from joining a religious order who are gay, and that wasn't quite as true a few years ago. Am I reading this correctly?
Well, yes and no. There was a document that came out in, I think, 2005 from the Vatican that said that men with deep-seated homosexual tendencies could not be admitted to seminaries or ordained. Now, different bishops interpret that different ways. Some bishops say deep-seated means that's the most important thing in your life, right? Like, you know, I'm gay first and foremost. Other bishops say that it means that, you know, you can't live celibately. Other bishops say that it means what it says, which is, you know, if you're gay, you can't enter. So it really didn't change very much because the bishops who were allowing people in their seminaries who were gay, who could be celibate, you know, or religious orders who could be chaste, continued to do it. And I know probably hundreds of celibate gay priests and chaste members of women's and men's religious orders who are doing great work and, you know, live their vow of chastity and live their vow of celibacy. And so do most people in the United States in the Catholic Church. There was a Father Greiton, I think, in Milwaukee that just came out with the approval of his archbishop, Archbishop Listecki, you know, who's a very traditional, you know, an Orthodox Catholic archbishop. And everyone was delighted. Why shouldn't he? He's living celibately. He's chaste. He's a good priest. What's the problem? So, but yes, there has been this document, but I don't think it's really changed a whole lot.
Even with Pope Francis, we talked about Pope Francis last week. Do we have any inkling about what he thinks about gay clergy?
We do, because he was asked directly, what do you think about gay clergy? And that was where his famous answer, who am I to judge, came up. People tend to forget that wasn't about LGBT people initially. It was about gay priests. And he said, if a man is seeking God sincerely, who am I to judge? The next day, they pressed him, and they said, well, you were only talking about gay priests. And he said, no, actually, that applies to all gay people. So that's exactly what he thinks. Who am I to judge?
You bring up one thing that you're not thrilled about in terms of what is actually by the book in Catholicism, and that is referring to homosexuality as a disorder. How can that be rectified?
Well, that's a good question. I think we really need to look at the language that's used. I mean, our sexuality, in a sense, touches everything we do, right, including the way we love, even when the sexual expression of that love is not involved, right, or even contemplated. So to call a person's sexuality objectively disordered or intrinsically disordered is really to tell a person that all of his or her love, even the chaste love or the celibate love, is disordered. And for most people, that seems really cruel. Revising that language has been discussed by several bishops. I quote a bishop from Australia that talks about it in my book. But I think the most important thing is a comment that a mother said to me. She said she had a kid who was gay, a boy. And she came up to me and she said, do people understand what that kind of language could do to a 14-year-old boy? And you know what she said? She said it could destroy him. So we need to pay attention to the language we use, too, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Intrinsically and objectively disordered. That is really strong stuff. Now, you can say something like, I mean, you know, the Vatican could say, they could speak, they say differently ordered, right? Or they could, that's one theologian suggested recently. But, you know, to say that someone is objectively or intrinsically disordered in themselves is a great cruelty, I think.
If you're
you are a disordered person in yourself, in the way that you love. And that's just really cruel. So I think we need to rethink the language that we're using as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Father James Martin, the author of Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. I'm curious, are you aware of how this subject is treated in other parts of the world? I'm guessing that in many parts of Europe, they're looking at us and they're saying, are you kidding me? And then I also suspect that Africa, the Catholic community in Africa, is saying, you're wimping out on us. Do I have those stereotypes too ingrained?
Wimping out in what sense?
In terms of, no, we have to be even more hardcore on people.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think it depends on the country and even sometimes the diocese or the bishop. But, you know, Germany, for example, has been very forward-thinking about these things. France, England, much more open. At the Synod of Bishops on the Family, there was the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna talked about same-sex marriages positively, right? I mean, which was kind of almost unthinkable here in the United States. And yes, I mean, I spent 2 years in sub-Saharan Africa in Kenya, so I know that part of the world fairly well, even though it was 20 years ago. And I was told back then by several priests, there are no homosexuals here.
Really?
In the priesthood, but just in the country.
Wow, how did they do that?
That does not exist. So yeah, and, you know, in some places, the church leaders have actually sided with some of these discriminatory laws about outlawing homosexuality. So we have the church, you know, and of course, so the Pope, when he speaks, has to recognize that he's speaking to the entire church. And so some parts need to be brought along a little more slowly, but that does not negate the need for prophecy. We should still be prophetic, particularly when it comes to life issues, i.e. people being executed or beaten up. I mean, I don't care who you are or who you're attracted to. No one deserves to be beaten up or executed.
Yeah,
so and the church, I think, needs to really speak. You know, where is the church in those countries in terms of these life issues?
And I think what we have seen in past decades is that there was sort of a silent permission. I think that if you approached a priest in, say, 1965 and said, you know, this guy down the street, Bobby, is gay and I feel like beating him up, the priest would probably say, no, I wouldn't do that. But at the same time, there was this blind eye towards violence and disrespect towards people who were even not necessarily gay, but effeminate.
Right. And, you know, and there's still this gross misunderstanding in many Catholic priests. I heard a story. I spoke to the man who was a 30-year-old autistic man who came out as gay to his family. And, you know, imagine how difficult that must have been, right? So he's 30 years old. He's not in a relationship, so therefore he's not doing anything wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
According to the church, he's just gay. His parish priest told him he could no longer receive communion in the church in front of everybody because he was a scandal. So the parish priest said, if you wish, you can receive communion privately with me in the rectory.
And this is how long ago?
Last month.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So this is the kind of baloney, and I was going to use a worse word, that people have to put up with. I mean, I hear these stories regularly. That's a month ago. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And you know, and so people are... There's still this, and that's where respect comes in. That is done for no other reason other than the man is gay. That's it. He's not doing anything wrong.
Aside from...
I would say that's sinful. I think what that priest is doing is sinful. It's more than a scandal. To stand in the way of someone in God is a sin. You know, I tell in this in the book the story of Zacchaeus. Remember in the Gospel of Luke? So Zacchaeus is a tax collector, and
oh, yes.
He's on the margins because he's seen as sinful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus comes in, and he cannot see Jesus because of the crowd. Now, you know, in the Gospels he's short, but it's a great emblem for people preventing someone from getting to Jesus. And I often say to crowds, think of Zacchaeus as an emblem of the LGBT community. He gets up into a tree just so he can see Jesus, because the gospel says he wanted to see who Jesus was, like this young man. Jesus comes, and who does he call to? He calls to that man, the person who was seen as on the outs. He comes down from the tree, and my favorite line, and the crowd began to grumble.
Mm.
That's what they're doing now. You know, they don't like any mercy being extended to someone who is seen as on the margins. And that's what we see. Zacchaeus stands his ground, and he says, boy, if I've done anything wrong, I'm going to repay people. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. So, you know, for Jesus, and Jesus does not say one word about, you know, you're a tax collector, stop doing it. He just welcomes him. And whatever change in life that needs to happen for Zacchaeus happens naturally. But, you know, this priest who is standing in the way of a young man and the Eucharist is... like the crowd. He's preventing people from encountering Jesus. So I always say to crowds, where do you want to stand? You want to stand with Jesus or you want to stand with the crowd?
Good point. Tell us about any opportunities you have when you are speaking to a primarily LGBT crowd, and one that has been hurt, or the people within that crowd, perhaps many have been hurt. They were raised Catholic or some other form of Christianity, and they've been hurt, and they just want to protest what they have been going through, and you perhaps might want to invite them back in. How does that happen?
Excellent question. I was at a group recently at a parish in New York that has a vibrant LGBT outreach program. And I said, how many of you have felt wounded by the church? Every single person, there were 200 people in the room. Every single person raised their hand, you know? So one of the things to do is, first thing to do is to listen, of course, what's their experience. The second thing to do is remind them, you were talking about bringing them back in. They're already in. I say, look, you're baptized. You are baptized. You have just as much a part of the church. You are just as much a part of the church as Pope Francis, as the local bishop, as the pastor, as me, period. So to kind of claim and name that sacramental grace of baptism. And then, you know, and then talk about ways that they can respond. You know, are there respectful ways that you can respond? Are there respectful ways to protest? Are there ways that will be really useful, right? But I think really the onus is actually more on the institutional church, on the hierarchy, because, you know, a lot of gay people have told me, which is really true, and I had to hear this because the first version of my book was a little soft-peddling some of the sort of permissibility of protest. But a number of gay people have said to me, well, you're a priest. You have all sorts of access to bishops, right? Those avenues are not open to us. And so sometimes we feel the only avenue that's open is sort of, you know, respectful protest. So I'm more open to that now. I understand that a little better.
What is a good way for that to happen? Envision, tell me how you envision respectful protest.
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, the onus is on the bishops. So the bishops, I think, first of all, listening to them, listening sessions. Cardinal Supich of Chicago talked about having one. Listening sessions, getting to know them as friends, right? Being willing to be challenged. I think for LGBT theologians to write more about, you know, the place of the LGBT person in the church. I think for people to not leave. You know, I know a lot of LGBT people. It's a hard question for me. It really is. This is probably the hardest. Is, you know, I feel like I want to leave the church, or I don't want to go anymore. And I can understand that, but by the same token, I say, look, you are a part of the church. You know, don't let people kick you out, right? It's your church. So there's a call for the individual LGBT Catholic to be in the church and to respectfully and lovingly and prophetically speak truth to power. So it's very hard for them. I think things are changing though for the better, frankly. Pope Francis has himself his own words about LGBT people appointing more LGBT-friendly cardinals and archbishops and bishops. Cardinal Tobin of Newark had a welcoming mass for LGBT people in Newark, New Jersey, which was a big deal. Cardinal Supich in Chicago, as I said, talked about listening sessions. You know, Archbishop Listecki in Wisconsin, you know, supported this gay priest who came out, celibate gay priest. And then, of course, you have more and more people coming out and therefore more and more families being affected and bringing that into the parishes. So I think things are actually changing for the better. And this pushback is kind of the last gasp of this homophobia in the church, I think.
Tell us a little bit about the chapter in your book entitled You Are Wonderfully Made, if you would.
Yeah, it's part of the section of the book, the second half, which is Bible passages and invitation to reflecting on them. It's from my Jesuit spirituality. So what can these Bible passages tell us in prayer? And Wonderfully Made is from Psalm 139. And in my experience, it's been one of the most helpful passages. It's not a very well-known passage, but in Psalm 139, the psalmist talks about how God knows him or her. And the great line is, "For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." It's just such a beautiful thing for people who've been told that they're crap, or they're intrinsically disordered, or they're objectively disordered, or they're sinful just by being gay, to read that and to hear you were made by God and you are wonderfully made. I almost call the book Wonderfully Made. But it's a great thing for people to read, and it's true. They are wonderfully made. They're beautiful creations of God, and we have to treat them like that. We have to reverence like that.
So in the last few minutes that we have together today here, Father, what's on the immediate horizon for you? More speaking opportunities, I'm assuming. Last week you mentioned you you've been speaking quite a bit, even with the gigs that did not go through because of protest.
Well, I have a lot of speaking engagements around the new revised and expanded edition of Building a Bridge on LGBT Catholics. But then I'm turning back to a book on prayer. So, you know, this is not my only issue or my only interest. And I also give talks on Jesus and prayer. And so, you know, I will respond as needed to some of these issues as they come up. But I'm also turning my attention to this big book on prayer that I'm working on.
And you're also still the editor at large of America.
I am. That's right. That's my
little hobby on the side.
Right. Yeah. So writing is part of, and writing books is part of my work here too. So that's my 9-to-5 job as a Jesuit.
I see. How about your pastoral duties? For instance, how often do you say Mass?
Well, I go to Mass every day. I say Mass every few days in my Jesuit community. And then on the weekends, I help out at a Jesuit parish. So I'm pretty busy. And then on top of that, I do confession, of course, and I do what's called spiritual direction, mm-hmm. you know, helping people with their spiritual lives. So there's the priestly part of my life as well. But it's all wrapped up in one. It's all part of my Jesuit vocation.
Sure. And do you have a website?
I do. There is my Facebook page, Father James Martin, S.J., for Society of Jesus. My publisher set up a website for me called jamesmartinsj.com, and then I'm also on Twitter at jamesmartinsj and Instagram at jamesmartinsj.
Wonderful. Well, Father, we appreciate so much the time you spent with us today and last week as well, and wish you the best of luck with this new and improved version of the book that's just come out.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today was Father James Martin, author of Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.